First of all, we will pay homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Actually, these days we are discussing Pena Pindupama Sutta, which is available in Khanda Samyutta. And here Buddha gives very beautiful similes to the five khandhas. As you know, all our experiences can be divided into five main groups. They are called the Rupakhanda, that is the form aggregate, and then the Vedanakhanda, that is the feeling aggregate, then Sanyakhanda, that is the perception aggregate, then Sankharakhanda, that is the fabrications or formations aggregate, and then the Vijnanakhanda, that is the consciousness aggregate. So likewise, the whole experience, all human experience, all beings experience can be divided into these five full comprehensive groups. And then if we are able to analyze our whole experience, then we can easily pay attention to each group and can get a better understanding. Now, related to the form aggregate, Buddha says it is like a kind of a form, F-O-A-M, kind of a form generated in a river bank. So once we approach it and once we check about it, then we understand it's a lump of form and there is nothing substantial there. It is simply empty. It is not worthy and it is filled with air. So it's a kind of a form. So therefore it is empty. It is not useful. It is not that, valuable. On the other hand, Buddha talks about the feelings, and feelings are like bubbles, water bubbles, so which is quite fragile, and once it is generated, it quickly bursts. So Vedana, the feelings are like that. So even though they appear like severe, or even though they sometimes appear like pleasurable, if we closely analyze what is inside, is fairly these kinds of impermanent, transient nature is available. So that is where we are trying to prepare our mind with a fairly focused attention, somewhat concentrated mind, and that concentrated mind being focused onto each and every feeling. And then we are trying to observe those feelings. It may be pleasurable feeling, there we are observing it. It could be painful feeling, there also we observe it. If it is an equanimous feeling, still we are observing it. So this observation helps us to understand their true nature. So whether they are lasting feelings or whether they are impermanent feelings, is it a single feeling or is it a combination of so many feelings? So likewise, we are understanding their true nature because of this observation. So Buddha mentioned these feelings are very much like water bubbles generated because of a heavy rain on a reservoir, on the water surface of a reservoir. Those are quite fragile, quite transient. And then we discussed last time about the perception aggregate. There are many perceptions, many signs that we store in our mind. So in our childhood, we are learning so much of information about the colors, about the letters, about the shapes, about various denominations, various norms, and maths, and so many subjects are nowadays available. And slowly we are learning all these signs, marks, and as a result we are able to communicate with others, and that leads to learn about various languages and to use them to communicate among the people. So likewise, we are fairly obsessed with various information. Nowadays we are in the information technology world, IT world, and as much as possible we give a lot of emphasis on this information, and now it is quite easy to acquire information, and as much as possible so we try to memorize them, we try to store them in our mind. And our behavior is quite conditioned because of these perceptions, because of these various signs. And Buddha says all these signs are very much like a mirage. Even though they appear quite true, even though they appear like real, they are not real. So these are quite difficult to understand at the beginning, because these perceptions, these various signs, marks, they all appear like very correct, very true, very important. But if we closely analyze, so they have their own fragile nature. Sometimes this information, these memories simply erased. So we can't remember what has happened. We can't remember someone's name. We can't remember whether we have seen or met him. So therefore, there's a somewhat impermanent nature even to these marks. And most importantly, using these marks, when we are trying to recognize another person, that also can give wrong results. Because sometimes we use some old information, old data with the present experience, and those old data might not match with the present data. There could be certain mismatching, and there could be certain discrepancies. And sometimes, depending on our wrong data, we start to think. With wrong perceptions, we start to think, and then our mind get colored, mind get conditioned. And if we continue to think like that, our mind get further conditioned, further somewhat fixed into a certain kind of a fixation, and then it is very difficult to come out of it. So we become kind of a dittigata, kind of a person who is fairly stand on a particular view. So that view could be a wrong view, and then we are strongly holding such wrong view, and then it is quite difficult to come out of that view, that wrong view. So therefore, Buddha mentioned all these perceptions are like a mirage. Even though they appear like true, they are not really true. And then today we like to discuss about the fourth aggregate. And fourth aggregate is called formations. Now, this is a very interesting subject. And here there are various fabrications, various preparations, various constructions we do. Say, for example, if you see a particular image, suppose you from a distant, you see something. It could be a kind of a shape. And this shape, once registered in the retina of our eye, then we give a kind of a value to it. Just before the value, actually, we give a name to it. We simply recognize it, assume that it's a kind of a shape of a woman. And then we give a name, okay, she's a woman. And we are to that image, to that mental image, we gave a name as a woman, a label as a woman. And then as we further closely observe it, then probably we can recognize, okay, she's my mother, she's my daughter, she's my wife, she's my sister. So likewise, we give another name to that. We add a relationship to it. So then we add another thing. Okay, she's beautiful, she's not good now, she's not well now, she's suffering now. So likewise, we add something more. And then we add something more. Okay, we see, okay, suppose she is now suffering from kind of an ailment. So we add some more. We think, okay, don't know whether she has gone to the doctor, whether she has gone to the hospital, whether she got the correct medicine, whether she has enough money to support herself. So now we are adding further and further. So likewise, once we see a little image, so we constantly start to weave a net. We start to fabricate. We start to construct. Actually, at the very bottom, at the very early stage, what we have seen is simply a mark, simply a sign. So at this situation, it's a simple image, a form. That's the only data that we had. But we didn't stop from there. We rather start to construct so much of other data into it. We started to add so many other parts to it, we start to color to it, and all our various perceptions are also added to it, our various likes and dislikes also added to it, and we are actually making a big thing. We are emphasizing it. We are adding value to it. We consider it as quite important, quite necessary to pay attention. There is something to work out, something to figure out, something to protect, something to look after, something to go and deal with. So likewise, we add so much and so much. So this is the fabrication. This is the construction. So once we get some sort of a sense impingement in this situation, we have seen a mental, we have seen an image, and to that image we have given a label, and then we further added, constructed, and we gave it a name, and then probably we have given a relationship, and then we are adding some past experience to it, and we may be adding some future plans to it, some more and more information, and likewise, so we are weaving a net. We are sort of going on, and ultimately we are in a complete thinking world. We are in a complete obsession even. So this obsessive way of thinking has the root as a kind of a sign. And so this addition, this construction, this fabrication, these formations, are coming under the sankhara khanda, the formations aggregate. Among these formations, various formations, Buddha mentions chetana, the volition, is the one of the most important formation. So we volitionally do something. We volitionally add. We volitionally construct. We volitionally act upon it. Assume that we have seen someone, and now she is in a danger, and so we go and immediately help her and protect her and all sorts of things. Or else suppose we have seen someone we don't like, so immediately we want to get out of the way, we want to run away, and so we are adding so much of action onto it. So the chetana, the volition, is also a part of it. So likewise, when we see something, so there are a lot of additions, a lot of fabrications. And that actually give life to our thinking. Previously, assume that our mind was quite silent. But now mind is thinking. Mind is proliferating. Mind is ruminating. It's going on and on, going on and on. Suppose you hear something, a small sound. So there could be some initial recognition. So that may be kind of a bell sound or very primitive level of recognition. So then we don't stop there. So we start to add to it. So then we are adding, okay, this is a very beautiful sound. This is an ugly sound. This is coming from another world. This is coming from a different angle. So I don't know where it is. This is a so and so. This is a likewise. So we are giving so much value to it, so much importance to it. And then we start to again view a net. Again, construct a kind of a hearing world. So now we are in a different world. So we have lost our pivotal point. We have lost our baseline. But now we are in a kind of a displaced place where we are thinking, we are constructing, we are fabricating, we are proliferating. So this is how the sankharas are working. Similarly, once we feel some sort of a smell. So we may have a small recognition telling, okay, this is a good smell, bad smell, it's a beautiful smell, this is a worthy smell, this is so and so, this is the name of the scent, this is the value of the scents. So likewise, so much of information we can add. So similarly, we get entangled in it. So when we are going through some taste, there also we can add. So we can recognize the taste. It may be bitter, it may be salt, it may be sweet. Likewise, we can recognize. So once we recognize, even we don't stop. We want to further fabricate it. We want to further enhance it, construct on it. So again and again, so much of thoughts are generated. Now we are thinking about what we have tasted. And we may even plan to have it on tomorrow. We may even plan to give it to someone else. We may even plan to have more and prepare by ourselves. So likewise, many different ways we can think. So this thinking, this fabrication is part of the formations aggregate. So actually, ultimately, where we are standing, where we are dealing with, is not based on that primitive information, but on which that we have created, on which that we have prepared. There was a kind of a triggering happened from that initial data, initial raw data, but there's a significant influence coming from our own likes and dislikes. So therefore, our experience is fairly colored, not just from the initial data, from that objective information, but there is a significant component part coming from our subjective information, from our subjective influence. Depending on our upbringing, depending on our culture, depending on our likes and dislikes, depending on our education, depending on our attitude, there are so many parameters contributing to the experience, and as a result, we start to add, start to color, start to change, start to construct, start to prepare, start to fabricate. So all are actually sankhara. All are formations. Similarly, if we experience some sort of a sensation, it could be a touching sensation, it could be a pressure, it could be heat, it could be kind of cold experience. So whatever it is, and there also we don't stop, we give some value to it. And as a result, we start to think about it. And if we continue to think, ultimately we can even get on to a kind of obsessive thinking. And interestingly, if there is a simple thought coming to the mind, so there also we can recognize, okay, this is thought. So we don't stop there. So that's the issue. So we, without stopping there, so we start to give a name. We start to want it more, and we want to add few more thoughts onto it. So more and more we start to think, and ultimately we can't even stop thinking. So this is a very interesting phenomena happening here. So at the beginning, actually it is happening as a result of cause and effect relationship. It's a kind of a conditioning nature. It's a kind of a dependent co-arising nature is there. So when a mind is aware of some amount, some kind of a mental image, aware of some kind of a mental object. So this is a kind of a cause and effect relationship. That is how the mind consciousness generate. There is no harm in it. And then we do the recognition. Okay, this is a lustful thought. This is a particular image. This is a sign. So likewise, we do some raw level recognition. That is also happening mostly as a cause and effect relationship. Still no harm. Then on top of that, we may be feeling happy, feeling unhappy, feeling lethargic, feeling lazy, feeling boring, bored, etc. So this is at the feeling level. There are also, we can deal actually, we can recognize. So if we attach to this feeling, if we recognize this feeling as something pleasurable, then we want to have it, then we want to own it, possess it. We want to keep it more and more. So there we are, we start to participate in the application, participate in the instance, or participate in the incident. So there we are adding a thought. So I want it. I want to have it. Now we are adding few thoughts. Now we are continuing thinking like that. Okay, we want to have it. We want to own it. What is the cost of it? I don't have money. I need to borrow money. So likewise, in many different ways, now we are thinking. Now we are coming to the level of fabrication, the level of proliferation. So once we step on to this, here we can't stop. Here now the momentum is very high. As a result, the thinking happens by itself. It has gathered its momentum. And we are like a slave in this process now. So even though now if we want to stop, we can't stop because it has accumulated a lot of momentum by thinking in many different ways, confusing ways, and that confusion, that thinking has built up a lot of momentum, and as a result, we are simply driven by that momentum. We are simply driven by that proliferation, and we can't come out of it. So this is the sort of the pathetic situation what is happening here. So even though at the very early stages it happens as a cause and effect relationship, and the next stage we participate volitionally, knowingly, so that is the second stage, and the third stage actually we are simply driven by it, and we are a kind of a poor victim of the process. So this is how the fabrications come into the very higher level or dominating level. So we are helpless on such situation. So we are like a servant of that thinking, servant of that proliferation, servant of that prapancha. So, but if we want to look back, if we are able to look closely, if we are able to go back in the thought process, thought generation, so there we can recognize slowly, once we are like unentangling a kind of a wool, if we are able to unentangle the situation, then we probably be able to recognize how many different ways the thinking has spread out. So if we can sort of make a kind of a mind map, so how it has prepared in many different ways, thinking has distributed into many directions, and ultimately if you are coming able to come to the root, so there is nothing there, there is nothing substantial there, there is no inner core. So they are simply very minute kind of signs are there, minute kind of feelings are there, minute kinds of perceptions are there. But on top of that, we have generated a lot of thoughts, a lot of thinking, a lot of coloring, a lot of fabrications, a lot of proliferation. So everything appears now like a huge monster. But if we closely analyze, if we go to the source, to the deep level, to the very primordial level, then there is nothing. There is nothing substantial. There is no inner core. There is no essence. So therefore, Buddha mentioned this is like a banana trunk. So Buddha gives here the simile. It is very much like a banana trunk. So from distant, it appears like something solid, something very strong. But if someone is able to cut the banana trunk and see what it is, what is inside, there is nothing there. Nothing substantial. If we slowly peel out each and every layer, so then ultimately it's a combination of series of layers. So once we peel out, there is nothing remaining. Everything was disappeared. So there is no any heartwood. So there is nothing substantial, nothing important, nothing valuable there. It is empty. It is hollow. It is invaluable. It's not worthy. So therefore Buddha mentioned, so this is how a practitioner looks about one's own fabrications, how one's mind is making all these fabrications, how one's mind is making all these views of thoughts or the nets of thoughts. And even though they appear real, even though they appear like a monster, but if we closely analyze, if we closely observe, there is nothing substantial. There is no inner core. There is no any heartwood. It is like a banana trunk. So therefore Buddha mentioned, these are the sankharas. Sankharas, even though as a resultant, they show something substantial, something important, but if we are able to closely analyze them, if we are able to apply the yoniso manasikara, looking deeper, looking to the source, going to the bottom, there one can understand there is no heartwood, there is no anything substantial, there is no any worthy heartwood or inner core inside. So it's simply empty. It is hollow. So more and more, if one is recognizing this nature, so then one loses the value on these sankharas, the value on these fabrications. And one will understand the futile nature of this fabrication. Actually, why mind is doing it? Why mind ignorantly continue to do this task? So one will understand. So slowly, if one is able to disentangle this whole thing, then slowly we'll understand no point of doing this, no point of proliferation, no point of adding, constructing, fabricating. Rather, better allow the mind to calm down, to stop fabrication, to calm down proliferation. Papancha vupasama, to allow the mind to rest, to relax. So this way the papancha vupasama happens. The calming down of the proliferations, calming downs of thinking, calming downs of the obsessions. Then the mind is resting, mind is relaxing, mind has become still. So this is actually kind of a very interesting aspect of the vipassana. So the calming down or stilling of all formations is a synonym for nibbana. So if one is able to calm down or tranquilize all the sankharas, fabrications, so that mind is a very peaceful mind. That mind is a very calm mind, quiet mind. So there are no fabrications. So such mind is something that Buddha encouraged, and he therefore mentioned and encouraged us to maintain a mind which is free from papancha, which is free from fabrications, free from formations. So with that, I like to conclude today's Dhamma sermon. Now I open the session for questions.
Avsai Bhante, there's currently three questions.
Yeah.
Question number one, mindful sitting. Dear Bhante, last time there was a question about getting support from the body when we are doing sitting practice multiple times a day. Bhante mentioned that it is very important and we should let the body adjust slowly to the posture and feel the comfort afterwards, which may take a couple of days. Bhante also mentioned that initially it might be possible to find some comfort if we can observe the breath continuously and build some concentration. During my practice, I have observed that if the day is good and I'm not distracted drastically, if the breath becomes subtle, the body discomfort, which arises after 20 to 30 minutes, gets cut off and I can go on for 40 to 45 minutes. There are a lot of ifs since my practice is not regular. Anyway, I have the feeling that this effect is due to concentration building to some extent and cutting off part of the body pains. Appreciate if Bhante can explain this for us, for us, the newcomers, so that we can get prepared for this temporary but important finding with metta. That's the end.
Yeah, actually, this is, as you quite correctly mentioned, this is a kind of a temporary state. So our body is seasoning in a way. So as we are continuing our practice, so body get used to the posture, and more it starts to cope up with the posture or to get used to the posture. So then slowly it starts to give enough support from the posture. So at the beginning it is not. At the beginning there are so much of pains and aches and all these difficulties. But with time, as we continue our practice, the body starts to adjust to this posture and body get used to the posture, and therefore we can maintain that posture for a long time. So then a lot of support from the body comes and we don't need to change the posture. So therefore, so what you are experiencing is correct, and there may be certain levels that we can reach where we don't need to change the posture and we can maintain even a couple of hours without changing the posture. So likewise, there are many other sides. Say, for example, if your mind is well concentrated onto some other phenomena, to breath or to rising and falling, or you are looking in some aspect of the mind. So on that situation, we completely pay attention to that phenomena and we neglect the feelings or the, various characteristics of the body. So as a result, we are completely now engaged on something else. So at that situation, actually, we can maintain a long posture. I mean, the long duration in the same posture, because we are completely into something else. But once we stop that and come back to the body, there may be, again, we may feel aches and pains. So therefore, it depends. So as we develop our concentration, so the concentration actually helps to tranquilize the body. And the other side is also there. If the body is fairly concentrated, it helps to develop concentration. So if the mind is now well concentrated on some phenomena, then we are not much bothered about the aches and pains of the body. So therefore, it has a kind of a cumulative effect where the samadhi is now improving and the body aches and pains are disappearing. And we get a lot of comfort, kind of a blissful experience through that practice. So therefore, these are certain experiences that we all can go through. And more, the body starts to give a lot of support. And at the same time, the mind also recognizes that it is even when the posture is changed, you can maintain continuous mindfulness. So likewise, many different ways we are educating the mind, and therefore we can flourish in our practice. Yeah.
Question number two or three. This is a really good one. It's from Satipasala or Mindful School. This is a 12-year-old response. Mindful walking. In mindful walking, I focused on my lower part of my body, specifically the sole of my foot. While I was walking, I could feel that the far side of my foot touched the ground first. Then it rolled so that my whole foot was on the ground. I could feel that my right foot did this. My right foot did this was more exaggerated than my left foot. As I kept walking, I felt an itch in my toes, but I tried not to scratch. Instead, watched it. I also felt quite hot because I was wearing long pants. I could be mindful on walking for 3 laps. Bhante, I have heard of this practice called slow walking meditation, where you take steps with your breath. I've tried it before and I felt calm at the end of it. It allows more sensations because we sometimes have to balance. But I think it can get confusing with two objects. Bhante, would you recommend this type of walking practice? That's the end of the question.
Actually, here it also depends, because sometimes if we start to watch very closely about how things are happening and you want to recognize various subtle information, then automatically the speed become less. So you start to slow walking because you are spending very fair amount of time on clearly recognizing very subtle information. So as a result, automatically you slow down. There is no harm in it, but we need to maintain some limit as well. Because if we become too slow, it's very much like a slow motion. Then you may lose the balance of the walking, because very much like you are doing one-footed kind of a situation. In such situation, you can't maintain the body balance. So you can't properly walk. Therefore, that's in such state, you need to compensate by introducing, say, some speed rather than extremely slowly walking. So, by the way, if we are not trying to look at very closely about this information and you are purposely slowing down the walking speed, so that is also not correct. Because as I mentioned, if you are closely examining the subtle information, as a result, if naturally your speed is reducing, that's no harm, no problem. There also you need to maintain some limit. But on the other hand, at the moment you are not closely examining certain phenomena, and not closely examining various bodily sensations, but you purposely slow down, so that is not expected. That may actually lead to some kind of a tiresome experience, because now you are walking in an artificial manner. This is not the way that you are used to walk. So therefore, maintaining some familiar speed, very comfortable speed, is the most appropriate, rather than you are trying to artificially walk. So there is nothing artificial here. So you ask the body to walk as it like, and then slowly you are incorporating mindfulness into the picture. So that is why we typically advise, so at the beginning, don't think that you are trying to be mindful. Don't think that you are doing any kind of a meditation. Rather, from this end to the other end, simply walk. Just start to enjoy walking. So you are simply walking from this end to the other end, from that end to this end. So likewise, you are familiarizing the distance, familiarizing the walking path, warming up kind of a thing. Later, as you are maintaining that, actually, after you recognize, after you allow the body to sort of familiarize with the situation, and then allow the body to walk as it like, and there now you are trying to incorporate mindfulness. Now, when the left foot is touching the ground, you are keeping your attention there. When the right foot is touching the ground, you are keeping your attention there. So likewise, we are slowly bringing mindfulness into the picture. So this way, we are not making anything artificial, because now the body is walking as its usual speed. So from someone else from the outside, if he see you, so he may can't recognize, okay, this fellow is doing any kind of anything special, because he is doing in the same speed. Of course, actually, he may recognize that you are walking in the same place. You may be something is wrong with you because you are not going to somewhere else, but rather you go from this end to the other end, again coming back, again going there. So they may think that something is wrong. But anyway, that doesn't matter. But you are walking in the same speed or the usual speed. So therefore, don't introduce any kind of artificial speed or any kind of artificial actions into the walking meditation. Rather, do it as natural as possible. So that is the most important and most comfortable way of walking meditation, because the very moment you purposely, volitionally introduce something special, something artificial, then you feel burdened. You feel a little alienated, because you have lost the balance. Because mind requires some amount of comfort. Mind should feel that I am at peace. So this whole experience is happening in a more effortless manner. So this happens actually as you are continuing your practice. So there are stages where body simply walks and you, like an outsider, simply watch it. So this is the area or the target or the destination that we are trying to reach. So therefore, don't purposely make the walking too slow. Yeah.
Question number three, might be the last one. General question. Dear Swami Mansa, is there a way we can engage in mental proliferation and time to time come back to the unentangled mindfulness? If Chetana is a major type of formations, then how can we engage in day-to-day activity of thinking about something purposely, for example, work-related activities? If I am mindful of my posture and knowingly it drifts away to some thinking and comes back to the posture again, would I commit to kilesa? That's the end of the question.
Yeah, that's a good question. So actually, we may not be able to completely calm down proliferation, and it requires fair amount of practice. But at least if we know now we are in a proliferation, now we have lost the mindfulness. You are completely on the proliferation. So that itself is a good alarm. So that is a good invitation to come back to the non-proliferation, to come back to the posture, to come back to the present moment, to establish mindfulness. So the moment that you lose your mindfulness, there's a high possibility that you are get on to some kind of proliferation. So that is the risk. So more and more you are mindful, so that is a safe attitude that where you can avoid proliferation, because you know, you very well aware when the mind is thinking. very well aware now mind is going to think too much, mind is sort of distracted. So you are very well aware. Then you can actually take some precautionary activity. You can either stop it, you bring your attention back to the breath, bring your attention back to the posture, you establish mindfulness, so you can take some action. But otherwise, if we don't have any mindfulness, then what is happening is continuously our habits, our defilements are continuously take us for a ride, and we are poor victims of that vicious thinking. This is the typical way of living. Actually, this is where many people are. So they are their own worlds. They have their own worlds. And they have their imaginary world. And in those worlds, they are quarreling with each other, and they are laughing with each other, they are crying with each other. So they have their own world, fabricated world, fantasies. So they live in a fantasy, live in a fabrication. So that is the typical worldly level. So at least if we know that now we are in a fantasy, now we are in a fabrication, then at least we can try our best to come out of it, to stop this fabrication. So this actually, there's a gradual improvement in this process. You can't immediately completely stop all the proliferations, but slowly we are trying to be mindful on some present moment activity. And the body awareness is something very useful in this situation, where you are trying to use the body awareness or the kayanupassana as a very useful technique for the mind to engage with. So you are giving some calming process like breathing, rising and falling of the body, which actually has the capacity to stop proliferation, to calm down proliferation. So more and more your mind energy is engaged with this kind of process. Assume that again and again you are paying attention to breathing. So as you continue that practice, so you forget to think. You forget to think. Rather, you engage more on the awareness. You are now being aware of each breath, aware of each out-breath. So the awareness is improving, the mindfulness is improving, and that doesn't require any sort of thinking, because these are direct experiences. You don't need to think in order to know your in-breath. You don't need to think in order to know your out-breath. It's a direct experience. So we are giving prominence to this direct experience and reducing our attention to the thinking. We are ignoring the thinking, ignoring various distractions, and again, as much as possible, we are giving more emphasis to this direct experience, that is the breathing, say for example. So as we are continuing this practice, then what happens is you probably can recognize, okay, now mind was completely engaged with, say, so many breathing activities, say, 100 in-breaths and out-breaths, 100 breaths, we can simply say, 150 breaths, 200 breaths. So during this time, so mind is quiet. Mind has forgotten to think. So mind is completely in the present moment, because the breath happens in the present moment. The body happens in the present moment. Whatever the bodily activity happens in the present moment. So the very moment that your attention is drawn to any sort of present moment bodily experience, we can say you are not in the proliferation cycle. You have come out of it. So as you are improving it, then you can recognize, okay, this thinking is not something that I have to be responsible, that I should not be taken as for granted, thinking that I always have to give prominence to it, I always have to obey to this thinking. So that sort of wrong thinking may disappear, and you recognize this thinking is something, is like another faculty. Say while you are driving a vehicle, you are passing a lot of other vehicles, other pedestrians, other, say, buildings. So they are like other other information, but you are not bothered about them. So similarly, so you may continue your practice, say being aware of breathing, but there are thoughts, but you can simply neglect them. So as a result, this thinking become weaker and weaker. So ultimately the thinking has completely disappeared. So you now can be fully aware of some bodily process with a very quiet mind. So this is where we experience complete cutting off of proliferation using kind of a meditative technique. But later actually, as you develop vipassana, you can actually understand how we are participating into the picture, how we are adding a lot of our likes and dislikes into the picture, how we are participating into the fabrications. So why not we stop it? So once we see something, why don't we stop it at the very knowing level? Why are we going further to think? We going further to generate thoughts, to write a book, to write a novel, to prepare a film. So why are we going to do that? So you will understand the futile nature of that our own weaving part, our own fabrication part. And we will understand, okay, so far what I have done is preparing my own film, directing my own film, and I am also part of the film. I am also an actor or actress in the film. And now I have lost my freedom. Now I have simply a part of the film. And I am now maybe becoming happy, becoming unhappy, becoming frightened, because I am in a film, I am in a dream. So Buddha's teaching therefore helps us to come out of this dream, to avoid proliferation, to recognize the futile nature of this fabrication. So as much as possible, therefore, Buddha encourages us to calm down proliferation, calm down fabrications, calm down constructions. So that or such mind, Buddha says, is quite peaceful. Yeah, I hope that would be sufficient to that question.
We have one more question, Bhante, just come in.
Right.
General question. Dear Bhante, what are your views on sleepwalking or other activities during sleep? I recently watched a documentary on the science behind it and experiences of people who do it. Some describe scary night terrors or running away from a fighting presence in the room. Do you think meditation would help people cope with or reduce these kinds of activities? With metta, that's the end.
Sleepwalking. So, I mean, probably as you improve your mindfulness, it actually helps you to recognize various hidden tendencies, our personal traits, and maybe childhood experiences, and because it improves our awareness. So more and more we are able to understand our inner nature. And when mind start to dream, suppose you are while you are sleeping, mind starts to dream. So that very moment, probably the mindfulness can recognize that. I'm not telling that you awaken and recognize it, but rather if you are able to develop mindfulness, that developed mindfulness is capable even to recognize when the mind starts dreaming or mind start to do this sleepwalking or when you are trying to come out of the bed, so getting up. So this probably your mind may notice because you have developed mindfulness. Because as you know, as we develop mindfulness, so it improves the sensitivity of the mind. So you become fully aware of what is going on. So that is why Buddha mentioned vidita vedana uppajjanti, vidita uppattahanti, vidita abbattam gacchanti. So whatever the feeling arises, it is known to you. Whatever the feeling persists, it is known to you. Whatever the feeling disappears, it is known to you. So without your noticing or without your notice, so nothing can happen. So to such level, you are fully awake. To such level, your mind has become fully aware. So therefore, definitely the improvement of mindfulness, meditation, definitely may help you. But I can't say completely that it may help to completely stop it. But you can recognize, okay, this kind of habit is now going to happen. So you are coming out of the bed. Now you are straightening up. So likewise, your mind may start to tell you about these activities because of its sensitivity and the mindfulness. And furthermore, during the meditation, you can recognize these patterns in the mind. So as I mentioned, the sort of the tendencies in the mind. So that way you may be able to take some corrective measures and to sort of cure the mind. So I feel so this is the way that we can make use of mindfulness practice onto this kind of a situation. And again, actually, I can add another few words. There are certain other Western psychologists who have given some value to the dreams. And probably, you don't know the while walking, you are dreaming. So probably you can check whether the dreams are also involved. And probably those dreams may have some sort of a message. That is another area that certain scientists have given some emphasis. Yeah.
We have one more question coming. Question number 5, general question. Swamin Mahansa. The Dhamma, avidya paccaya sankhara, does that mean as long as we don't get rid of avidya, we are subjected to getting sankhara? Much merits with metta. That's the end of the question.
Yes, we can say yes. Because of the ignorance, the sankharas are happening. Because of ignorance, we do the fabrications. Because we think that we may get some sort of enjoyment because of this fabrication. That is why we don't stop. Say that you see something. There's a kind of a mental image happens in the mind. So we may think, okay, by using this image, so I can be happy. So you add a value to it. You given some emphasis to it. You are adding some value to it. So as a result, we are in the fabrication, we are in the construction. So at the very early level, if we know this is a simple, phenomena right now happening, it's a kind of a cause and effect relationship. So the I and the form is in contact. Now the I consciousness has arisen. It's a kind of a conditioning process. Now it is depending on so many other causes and conditions. So expecting happiness from this is not correct or not giving me lasting results, lasting happiness. So if that kind of understanding is there in the mind, then we may not do the fabrication. So likewise, actually, I have given only one example. So likewise, there are many, in-depth understanding about what is really going on, especially to the cause and effect relationship. So if one has such kind of an understanding, very profound understanding, so one may stop fabrication. One may stop adding so much onto one's experience, coloring one's experience. Because one has removed to fair extent this ignorance. So the mind has become fairly wise. Instead of ignorant, mind has become wise. So that is why Buddha mentioned one has to develop wisdom in order to penetrate the consciousness, the vijnana. Panya bhave tabba vijnanam parinyaya. So if one is developing wisdom, so that wisdom helps us to understand the what you call this fabricating nature, the illusionary nature of the mind, especially the consciousness. And the illusionary fabricative nature that we are doing, we are participating, we are constructing. So all these unnecessary participation we can recognize. So that is actually the development of the wisdom. That is the development of the insight. So more and more the insights are developed, more and more the wisdom is developed. So such mind may avoid fabrication. So that is why Buddha mentioned, especially in the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta. So the Arahant's mind is free from fabrication, free from manyana. Sabba manyitanantveva samatikkamo munisantoti ucchati. Buddha mentioned that all the conceiving, if one is able to calm down, that person is called an Arahant. Yeah, we can conclude the session then.
Yeah, that's the last question we got right there. We're going to do, although this is finishing the question and answer, we're going to do a guided sitting anyway after this, so please stay on. So to conclude the question and answer session, I'd like to thank Bhante and pass on our merits for giving up valuable time for this program, as well as the people working behind the scenes, those seen and unseen helping or participating in this program. And lastly, to all the participants, because without you, there would be no program. Teruvan sannai.
Teruvan sannai. So please continue your practice. So I am leaving the session now. Thank you very much for your participation.
Thank you.